listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I am not Steve Bertrand. I'm John Hansen filling in today. A gorgeous Thursday afternoon, at least in downtown Chicago. Maybe a little bit windy, and the old saying and song used to go, it's a great day to fly a kite. But these days, Dennis Rotkin from Crane Chicago Business, it's a great day to fly a drone for our photographers out there, right? Maybe a little windy, but...
That was a really sharp segue. Look, that was really good. Right? Yes. Drones are taken off in real estate photography this year. It's, you know, we expected it would happen over the past couple of years, mm-hmm. but there have been delays, John. A lot of them had to do with the FAA not being quite sure where its rules were going to go. So individual photographers were kind of waiting for their certification.
Because if you're going to make money off of it, you will certainly want to be within your legal realm.
Well, yeah. Plus, 2 years ago, I wrote about a guy who was a real innovator in the field in Chicago, and he got cracked down on by mm-hmm. the FAA. So everybody had been kind of waiting. So two things have converged this year. One, a lot of those single photographers are getting certification from the FAA this spring. And two, the largest real estate photo agency in America, VHT Studios, based in Rosemont, but they're the biggest all over the country, has a group of certified drone photographers. So you see the big player mm-hmm. and a lot of the little players all finally getting to
chomp
take
up
off
at the
this
bit.
Year.
Yeah. I got to ask, so what's the advantage of taking a drone shot? I imagine this isn't for every single home listing. Is it so you can see a good look at the property, maybe took a look at some parks in the nearby area?
Yeah.
Or is it just that it looks cooler and it's a more appealing listing?
Oh, it totally looks cooler. And I think somebody's going to find a way to make things like a condo look good with a drone. But for now, drones are best for like an estate on the North Shore. You fly the thing up and you see, look at all these trees. It's also really good for showing, here's how close we are to Lake Michigan. Here's our proximity mm-hmm. to that. There's also the flying up and seeing the parks. But one problem you have with that is there are rules against photographing somebody else's property without their permission. So you got to get all that.
You got to get all the signatures
right.
in.
Right. So not the public property, but right. what's between you and the park would be an issue.
Otherwise, it's going to be blurred out.
Yeah, exactly. But there's like on Google Maps. But basically, if you've got a big piece of property, also if you have a real sort of busy roof, you know, turrets and that sort of stuff mm-hmm. up at the top, crenellations, then a drone comes up and really sort of shows the house's gingerbread, that kind of thing.
And I imagine this isn't the sellers that are going to be paying for this. This is the real estate agents that are looking for the newest in to have a step up on the other agents out there, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Although it's not, you're not going to have much of an edge anymore, but because of VHT, almost everybody will be doing it.
I couldn't believe the number. I thought maybe this has happened a few dozen times in Chicago. 40,000 for sale homes in the Chicago area last year have been photographed from the air?
No, 40,000 for sale. 40,000 homes were shot by VHT in general.
I see. Okay.
They don't yet know how many they'll shoot this
right.
year because this is the year they roll
brand
it out.
New. Absolutely stuff.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. We got so much to talk to. You send so many stories over to Steve.
No, I'll write fewer stories.
No, they're all great stuff. You have a headline here. Why that $2 million home is taking longer to sell. My obvious answer is because it's $2 million. But for people that can afford this stuff, I imagine this is, I don't want to say necessarily a serious issue, but why are those $2 million homes tough to sell?
Because there are so many of them on the market now.
Really?
Yeah. So the story of the real estate market this spring, especially in the city, but also in the suburbs, is short inventory. One of the reasons homes are selling for a little bit more, one of the reasons they're selling quickly, is short inventory. The opposite is true when you start at $2 million and go up. Long inventory, too much. Part of that is because there were a lot of big sales a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money in the market, so people were saying, then I'm going to either rush onto the market my existing high-end home or build some new high-end homes. So now there's too much. There may also be wealthy buyers who are saying, one person who deals with that market said, there's some concern about where the economy is
right,
going,
yeah.
what's happening in the Chinese markets. Because if I own a $5-6 million house, it's not my only asset. If I own a $150,000 bungalow, it's probably my only asset.
Is this a Chicago localized problem or?
I only looked at the inventory in Chicago, but there is some cooling off in other markets, but I know Chicago best. And so the people might be pulling back because I don't know what's happening with my whole portfolio.
Right.
Right. So I don't want to move on a house while my investments and other things might be changing value. So that's one reason that buyers at that and are pulling out or pulling back,
mm-hmm.
while in the lower parts of the market, they don't seem to be.
Yeah, I just didn't know if maybe the uncertainty of property taxes in Chicago and Chicago's economy as a whole, not only nationally, but locally, would have any play of that.
It does. I can't yet quantify that. I've been on that property tax story, and you do think, first of all, we know the property tax increase is going to hit more upper end, more affluent homeowners than anybody else because of the way it's structured. But also, if you own an upper end home, it obviously hits you for more dollars. So there is sort of a whisper that people are maybe a little bit less likely to buy in the city, but I haven't yet been able to prove that.
And last but not least, we've been talking, obviously, the NCAA tournament starting today, and we talk about the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight, and you've picked these Elite Eight suburbs where home selling has really sprung in the recent future. We're talking the first few months of the year. Things are going really well.
Yeah, eight suburbs where what I like to say is both teams have come onto the court, because I talked about short inventory. In these suburbs, a whole lot of people have brought inventory onto the market, but at the same time, a whole lot of buyers have gone in and bought. So you're not lopsided. You don't have a shortage of supply, or you don't have a shortage of buyers. Either one, you know, makes you just not quite as sharp. But in eight of these places, Highland Park, Frankfort,
I'm quizzing you here.
Yeah, Wilmette, sorry.
Bartlett,
Roselle.
The Park Forest, Park Ridge, yeah.
These are places where a whole lot of people have brought homes onto the market and a whole lot of people have bought. So what I said is, you know, spring has really sprung. The spring market has really begun in those towns. And by the way, that's only eight out of 165 suburbs and 77 neighborhoods. Those are the only ones that have really pushed ahead.
Interesting. Yeah. So the ones that are doing well are doing great.
The ones that are doing well are doing great. It doesn't mean the others are doing badly. They're mm-hmm. just, they may have a lot more buyers than sellers. They may have a lot more sellers than buyers.
Yep. Dennis, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Dennis Rotkin, real estate reporter for Crane Chicago Business. Don't know why I'm struggling to say that. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand. And Bill Geiger of Geiger Wealth Management joins me now, Chicago's retirement planning expert. We're going to be talking about the bull market. It's now 7 years old, and now we're looking kind of into the next few years. You know, recent news in Wall Street as we mark that seventh anniversary of the current bull market. And, you know, it all sounds like good news. Up is good, right? Mm-hmm. But Bloomberg says it's not. So, Bill, I got to ask, why aren't people, I guess, more excited about this bull market?
Well, I think it's primarily because everyone's looking over their shoulder. The economy isn't nearly as strong as what the White House would like us to believe. We have more people on unemployment. We have more people who have dropped out of the labor force. We've got more people on food stamps. And we've got China folding. Caterpillar announced this morning they're not selling as much heavy equipment. There's a lot of signs pointing to a slowing economy. And with an all-time high stock market, that's not good for the stock market.
So it's a little skepticism, even though the some of the numbers we might read about seem good. There's a skepticism, and that's why people have this sort of pessimistic outlook, perhaps.
Sure, yeah. And you know, whether we have a correction this year or next year, the primary people that really have to worry about this are people that are 5 years or so away from retirement. If you're getting close to retirement, you can't take that kind of risk. If you lose half your portfolio 5 years out from retirement, you're not going to retire. At least not the same way you thought you would.
Well, I mean, it's essentially 30 years of unemployment after you retire.
Is that
your line?
That's my line. I told Steve Cochran that about a year and a half ago, and he keeps saying it over and over again.
So what does that mean for people? So it's obviously right to worry. So where do they go from here?
The first thing they really need to understand is how much risk they have in their portfolio. Now, a lot of people are walking around feeling like they're well-diversified, in quotes, mm-hmm. and that they're kind of protected. And we routinely do a series of analysis. One of them is by a very, very expensive version of Morningstar that looks at what your risk is. And we see portfolios that people feel like they're really well-diversified that in the next 2008, they'll probably lose 40 to 60% of their money.
Wow.
And that's a real wake-up call. So our best advice is if you're 5 years out or so from retirement, really sit down and understand how much risk there truly is in your portfolio. Make sure you got a handle on that. And because now, the time to get a handle on it is not at the bottom.
Right.
It's at the top.
Does some of that naivety come from the fact that, you know, it's just so easy to go on our computer, see what the number is, and then ignore it and forget it and not really dig into what all those numbers mean beyond it?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of conventional wisdom that gets repeated over and over and over again. And we take some of this stuff for gospel. You know, if you're well diversified, if you own a lot of different things, when one thing goes down, the other things go up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 2008, everything went down.
Yeah.
40-60%.
Doesn't matter how diverse your portfolio is, right?
2001, if you had stock in your portfolio, every single bit of it went down 40-60%. So a lot of this conventional wisdom that we've operated under, when you dig down below it, if it was ever true, it's not true anymore, at least not for the last 15 years.
So what specific things can someone do besides just kind of getting a little bit more educated to protect those retirements against those possible this long overdue correction that you say is coming?
Well, one of the things you can do is you can actually really diversify and take some of your money out of the stock market and start creating an income for yourself when you retire. You know, we concentrate on the size of our portfolios. There was even one firm that said, do you know your number? Like, if you have this magic number, everything's going to be okay. But the thing that makes the world go around when you retire is income. When those paychecks stop coming in and the Social Security is not as much as your bills, you need income to close that gap and then some. So what a great time to begin that transition. Reduce your risk, start creating some income, 5 years, 10 years out from retirement.
I think it's one of those things that we just assume that it's going to be there, and we don't think that we need to add any more revenue to that stream, that number is going to last the whole time.
That's not true.
I'm a little naive. True. I'm a little young, so I'm glad I'm hearing this now. A good early lesson for me.
John, I'd like to do something special for our listeners today.
Ooh, okay.
I can't do this for everybody, but I know you're going to read about this in just a moment, but for the next 5 callers who call in who have at least $500,000 in their retirement portfolio, I'm going to sit down with folks personally on a complimentary basis. If there's $3,000 value, but I'm going to do it complimentary, a full-blown retirement plan for them, and I'll sit down with them personally and help them put that together.
So you'll look at all the you'll be the educator in that situation.
I've been doing it for 30 years.
X's and O's. Bill Geiger, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. Nothing could be more frustrating than working hard your entire life, saving as much as possible for retirement, and then having no idea how you're going to make your nest egg last 20 to 30 years or more. And that's where Bill Geiger, Chicago's retirement planning expert, comes in. Bill joins us every Thursday and would like to make this very special offer to you. A full-blown financial plan, a $3,000 value, absolutely free, with no obligation to the first 5 callers who have at least $500,000, $500,000 saved for retirement. Just call 800-681-2498. That's 800-681-2498. You deserve the security and independence of knowing that you're doing the right thing with your retirement nest egg. Be one of the first 5 callers for your complimentary, no obligation, full-blown financial plan. You've earned it. Now it's time for your money to start working for you. Call Geiger Wealth Management today at 800-681-2498. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on this gorgeous Thursday afternoon. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. You know, for every new product out there or industry upstart, there is an incumbent that's got to kind of defend its position as the leader. And that's where defensive marketing comes into play. Now, Elise Glink is the co-host of Monday Morning Marketing on WGN Plus and owner-founder of Think Glink Media. Elise, thanks for joining me, even though that Steve's out today. Whoop. Elise, are you there now?
Yeah,
there we go. See, I fill in for Steve for the first time, and of course, I don't know any of the buttons, so my apologies to Yana. To you. Thanks for joining me, even though I tried my best to hang up on you.
It's a pleasure, John.
Yeah, it's great to meet you. So we're talking about defensive marketing, and you know, can you kind of explain a little bit more what that is? Like, if we're watching commercials, when do we know when we see defensive marketing? What does it look like?
You know, it probably doesn't look like much to the average person if the company is doing it correctly. But what it is when you've clawed your way to the very top, right? You're the number one in the marketplace. Defensive marketing is what you do to stay there. So if you think about Facebook and Google and the rivalry that they have between each other, Google introduces something, let's say circles, and Facebook introduces a way for you to categorize all the people that you know into smaller groups so you can email them directly. that's the kind of jockeying for position that you might see. Microsoft has been great at this, and then you get something like Google Plus, and then Microsoft feels like it has to come back. On the flip side, you've got Google Search, and then Microsoft is trying to catch up with Bing. And so when you to the average consumer, what you might see is a price war, for example, might be a way for you to recognize defensive marketing.
You know, I find it interesting because I was trying to come up with sports references for this to help people like me understand it. I don't know if you're a big football fan, but sometimes when a team's up big and they, you know, the Bears are up big, if let's say that were to happen once in a while, they go
once
into something. Yeah, they go into something they call like prevent defense, where they kind of stand back pretty far. They let, you know, the competitor kind of chip away, but try and prevent the big score. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Defensive marketing is to never really allow yourself to sit back on your heels, right?
Yeah, there's not really, you know, if you're looking for a sports metaphor, I was trying to think of this as well, because I know that your background is sports, and I'm not such a great sports person. But, you know, in my mind, defensive marketing is when you've got two teams that are fighting for the same kind of players, and one team is at the top of the heap, and they're doing their best to try and stay at the top. And so the acquisitions they might make in terms of talent might be a little different to keep themselves up there than if they were at the bottom of the heap trying to claw their way back up. You might be thinking that you're going to, like Moneyball, the whole Moneyball thing, where you're going to try and play the odds in a little bit of a different way. If you're at the bottom, you're going to take more risks. At the top, you may not.
I find it interesting that, you know, I immediately went to advertising, that we would see something different in the advertising. But really, sometimes they must try to identify what threat a lower competitor has. And they might, I mean, like you said, with the Facebook thing, change the way of operations in a way and try and show people that they are still the best option.
I think if you're out there as a company and you've got something that you do really, really well, maybe you're a restaurant, maybe you're, I don't know, maybe you sell tires, whatever it is that you do really well, you've always got to be looking for who's coming up behind you, who's new, hot, and different, and what are they doing. And one way that you can enact defensive marketing is the minute you see something, let's say it's restaurants, right, and the restaurant next door is doing a drink promotion for happy hour. Well, the minute you see that, you might have a happy hour plan that you pull off the shelf, and you enact that to meet or beat their price. If you can meet or beat their price and you're offering something even better and you're a better-known company, then you're going to be practicing what's known as defensive marketing, because you're defending your position at the very top.
Does a lot of that involve you know, a cut into revenue in the short term, but since you're bigger, you know you can outlast it and survive longer?
You know, one of the case studies is the case of Tylenol. And Tylenol had some sort of a competing product that was starting to creep up. And they absolutely cut prices. They got out there with their marketing. They started sponsoring a bunch of different kinds of events. And I'm sure in the short term, the revenue did take a hit. In the long term, they became the big-time player and the go-to drug for that sort of thing. And I think that that's a really good example of how a short-term hit can mean millions and millions of dollars in the long run.
I imagine a lot of businesses, when they see other competitors, it's an opportunity to look themselves in the mirror and see maybe where their shortfalls are, or maybe where this other company does things better. And the example that just comes to mind is Comcast's push in the last few years to talk about how they're trying to like start over fresh. They're bringing in, you know, they're going to have new customer service. Or Domino's, I think it was, that they're like, we're listening to you. We're going to create all new pizza. Would that fall under the realm of defensive marketing?
Yeah, it depends. It probably, for the cell phone companies, I think absolutely. You'll see Netflix against like an HBO or against regular cable. You might see some defensive marketing going on where cable tries to prove its value and might give special deals because they know that Netflix is kind of, people are like, well, I'll just watch Netflix or be on my computer. And so you're starting to see changes in how people defend their top spot. And I think that one of the things that I think any company can think about, right, is if you're at the top and you're trying to stay at the top, it really requires a whole lot of research. You always need to be knowing what your competitors are doing, what the new hot differentiating thing is, and you have to have a plan for putting that out very, very quickly. You can't be caught with your pants down, right?
No, so it's never a good idea.
Do, right? Is that a sports metaphor? It might be.
It could be.
But you never really want to be caught that way. And so planning ahead of time is really going to be the key thing to do. It's going to be the differentiator. And knowing what you can do and kind of having shovel-ready things to do, that's going to help keep your defensive marketing right at the top.
We've been talking about big companies with smaller companies nipping at their heels, but I bet there's examples, too, where a big company is moving into an area that maybe a local small business had kind of dominated in that sense. We see that all the time in Chicago's neighborhoods. And they can employ, the small business can employ a little defensive marketing as well by saying, you know, hey, this big company's coming in, but we're the ones that know your name. Is that, it can go both ways, right, a little bit.
It absolutely can. Think about real estate companies. You've got in Chicago some New York-based and some from other places outside the city that are coming in here. It's not like At Properties, which is homegrown, or Baird & Warner, which has been around for 150 years. But you're starting to see some companies come in from New York that really are just don't really have traction. And they're not buying their way in, but they're going to be fighting and doing what they can to get chunks of the business in different neighborhoods. The established brokers for those neighborhoods are going to have to do some defensive marketing here, or they're going to watch these upstart companies, which, by the way, are not small at all in New York.
Right.
They're huge. They've gone over big time. They have the resources to come in and act like big players, even though they're new to a market. The real estate agents are going to have to fight for that.
Elise Glink is the co-host of Monday Morning Marketing on WGN Plus and the owner-founder of Think Glink Media. And I believe we can follow you on Twitter @Glink, right? Nice and simple?
You can.
Absolutely. We would have had more time, Elise, but I hung up on you twice. I'm so sorry.
Next time, John.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. This is the noon Winter's Business Lunch, and we're going to be talking about to a hair salon. They do some really cool things. They recycle everything down to the hair. We're going to hear about that after a quick break on the Noon Business Lunch. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Happy Thursday afternoon and a gorgeous St. Patrick's Day here in the Chicagoland area. Now, when you get your hair cut, obviously you love to, and you're so used to seeing the people sweep away the hair, and I always assume it goes into the garbage, and I'm sure at most hair salons it does, but not in the Ukrainian Village, Humboldt Park area at Starship Salon. And joining me now is Tricia Starr. She's the creative director and senior stylist. Tricia, thanks so much for joining us. Tricia, you there?
I can hear you.
All right. Very good. I'm having my problems with the phones today. So, Tricia, you know, I've been to your salon before, and I always, you know, assume the hair went into the garbage. But you guys have started a really cool new program that recycles everything and gets rid of everything. And you guys end up with, what, only one waste basket full of garbage over, what, an entire month or a couple weeks?
Yeah, every couple weeks. So we just have, it's about a 3-quart trash can at the front desk. That's the only stuff that goes actually into the trash. Everything else is either recycled or composted.
Tricia, by the way, has a young son. I don't know if that's what's banging in the background or whether it's your husband, perhaps. I don't know.
Logan.
So, Tricia, you know, I got to ask, as a small business owner, I mean, this is obviously, you guys are cruelty-free products. You love doing that sort of stuff. But this is a big step for you guys because, obviously, at least I would think, it's going to cost more to go through all this effort to make sure that everything is recycled and the hair is composted. Is that accurate?
Well, the crazy thing about it actually is as a business owner, it actually costs us less to take this approach, which I was pleasantly surprised with, because you would think that it would cost you more money. I ended up coming out saving money by joining the composting program and by joining this recycling program.
Where do you start with something like that? Like, who's your first call to? Do you just go on the internet and Google Compost Company Chicago and then figure out who can help you out?
That's exactly what I did, yes. I realized after we joined the recycling program that what we had left over was mostly things that could be composted. So at that point, I just went online and I was like, is there any place in Chicago that can provide this services? I found a company called Collective Resources that composts all across the city, residential and commercial. And they come once a month and pick up a 5-gallon bucket of all of our composting for us.
How much
it's
of a...
Great. They come on a bike.
Okay. Oh, they come on... That's as renewable as it can be. No carbon footprint out of a Starship Salon in the Ukrainian Village on Chicago Avenue. I got to ask, Tricia, how much of a learning curve was there with your employees? I imagine at first, you're so used to how we do things in normal life, throwing things away, that it takes a little while to train your employees.
You know, the great thing about it with Green Circle Salons, they came in and spent a couple hours of a training session. Our team members are amazing and everybody was super on board for it. It takes very little effort. It takes us maybe 5 minutes at the end of the day to sort through everything and just being a little more mindful of where we put everything. But you'd be surprised. The effort isn't that much more and the cost isn't that much more.
Do you know of other salons that do this, that are able to make sure they save all this stuff?
I don't know of any other salons that compost. Green Circle Salons is an amazing organization that started in Canada that allows salons to recycle chemical waste, foils, everything that they use in the salon. And it finally made its way to the States, and it is gaining popularity. And I hope it just becomes a standard, really.
I imagine
I'm excited that we're on the forefront, but yeah. I hope that it becomes a standard in the industry.
Do you think that customers, because I do know that you put on your hair, you put like what, another extra $1, $1.50 on a haircut, right, for this extra, you know, for the cost of this?
That's correct. It's very similar to like when you get an oil change or something and there's a disposal fee. So it's called an environmental disposal fee, and it's $1.50. So we're able to pass this on to our clients as a disposal fee charge, which allows smaller businesses like ours to do something like this.
What has the response been from customers? A lot of shoulder shrugs or a lot of, oh, that sounds cool?
You know, we sent out a really comprehensive email when we started the program, and then we've been communicating it to each of our guests, getting them excited, getting them engaged. And, you know, everybody's just saying, sure, no problem. You know, I always try to say, if we see you, you know, 6 times a year, you know, it's under $10, you know, for you to erase your carbon footprint up to 96%.
Starship Salon is on Chicago Avenue, just west of Western, right around Campbell at the 2500 block. Tricia, good luck with everything. Thanks so much for joining us.